Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Scott Frerichs. I'm here today representing the Pro PRDB LLC, and I'm appearing in this matter on a pro hoc judicial basis. As you know, we're here today to talk about the Certificate of Review Statute, CRS 1320602. We submit that the trial court made an error right off the bat in analyzing the issue of whether to dismiss our claim or not, simply by relying on language from the appellate court opinion that has subsequently been reversed, and improperly shifting the burden onto the plaintiff to file something affirmatively with the trial court prior to the expiration of the 60-day period, and that failure to do so in the trial judge's mind essentially resulted in an irrebuttable presumption that nothing we said could result in our case staying alive. We believe the language from the Supreme Court in the Martinez v. Battis opinion is quite clear, as is the subsequent cases, that a plaintiff has the opportunity, when a motion to dismiss is filed based on a certificate of review statute, to either argue expert testimony is not needed and or that good cause exists to extend the deadline. In this case, the trial judge never considered our arguments. It is clear from the order the trial judge entered dismissing the action. He said it was up to you, plaintiff. The burden was on you to do something before you missed that chance. I'm not going to look at your arguments. The trial judge didn't even look at the good cause arguments and analyze the three-prong test that I believe every court, appellate court, that has addressed the issue has held is automatically reversible error to not acknowledge counsel, those particular aspects.
Counsel, before we get to the second part of your argument, which is sort of how I take the good cause argument.
Yes.
With regard to the first issue, the expert testimony and the need for a certificate of review, how is this case different than the Bojagreen, I probably killed his pronunciation, versus Gilbert case that's out there by the Court of Appeals?
Well, I'm not familiar with that one by name, Your Honor, but as far as our case, we cited several cases. There's no case in Colorado directly on point, but in an attorney malpractice situation, if an attorney fails to follow the client's express instructions, I want you to do this, and the attorney fails to do it, no expert testimony is necessary in order to prove up that case. In some sense, it's not that different from the statute of limitations case, which held no expert testimony was necessary. The client comes to the attorney and says, I need you to file this lawsuit for me. Well, implied in that is he wants you to file it in a timely basis, and the attorney fails to do so. But whether we look at it as every attorney should just know the statute of limitations and don't need expert testimony, or we could look at it from the perspective of, yeah, my client wanted me to file a timely lawsuit, and I failed to do that. One of the things I wanted to address here is there are really multiple levels to our appeal. One is obviously we want to get that decision reversed and get it sent back to the trial court. The other part of that is I'm looking for some guidance, or I shouldn't say I'm looking for guidance. I think the legal community would be well served to get some guidance on this particular issue, whether expert testimony is necessary when an attorney fails to follow the express instructions of his client, his or her client, as the case may be. One of the unusual...
This case involved what looks to me, at least at first glance, to be a fairly complex real estate transaction. Typically, unless it's clear, palpable, is what the case law says, an expert would be required in that circumstance. And what I hear you saying is your position is you're separating yourself from the complexity, and what I think you would recognize would typically be a complex real estate transaction case. And you're saying this isn't that complicated because really all we told him to do was to move some money into a certain place, and he didn't do it.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. If I were coming here and saying that the defendant gave my client bad advice on how to structure the transaction, then I agree with you. Expert testimony would be necessary. Whether the underlying transaction was simple or complex really isn't the basic issue here. It's the simple instruction that was given to the defendant, please take care of and pay off the liens on these properties as part of the closing. And the defendant took possession of the loan proceeds in order to do that and failed to do so.
Are we supposed to judge whether it's clear and palpable or whether it would be a little bit more complex by the allegations in your complaint?
I think that's all you have to go on now.
And did your allegations in your complaint ever just straight out say, you know, this is a failure to follow instructions case?
In those exact words, no. But the complaint lays out that the defendant was instructed to take care of the liens and failed to do so. And where I was going, I was saying on this express instruction issue, and Your Honor makes a good point that I also wanted to get to as well, is this motion to dismiss, it wasn't filed on the 61st date, but it was filed relatively quickly after the expiration of the deadline. No discovery was had. There were no depositions taken. All the information the trial court had in order to reach this conclusion was based on the pleadings. And I don't see how a trial judge can possibly, at that stage of the proceedings, appropriately determine or come to the conclusions, plaintiff, you have to have expert testimony in this particular case.
I thought you just told me a minute ago that we could decide based on the allegations, and now you seem to say that no, we can't decide based on the allegations.
If that's what I said, I certainly misspoke. What I said is, I don't see how a trial judge could, based on the limited record, come to the opposite conclusion and say, as a matter of law, you have to have expert testimony. Certainly, based on the allegations and the complaint, you could come to the conclusion that no expert testimony was necessary because our cause of action is not based on any professional opinion, trial tactics, strategies, things of that nature. In fact, Mr. Smith, the defendant, argues that he did not even have an attorney-client relationship with my client, and presumably would argue, if this case is remanded below, that there's not even a professional malpractice claim against him. He wasn't acting as an attorney for my client, which is one of the oddities of this particular case. On the one hand, Mr. Smith moved to dismiss the fiduciary duty claim, saying it was duplicative of the malpractice claim, but yet in his answer, he said, I don't have an attorney-client relationship with your client, with the plaintiff. And there are a lot of moving parts below with absolutely no record. But yet, based on the lack of record, essentially, trial court said, plaintiff, you have to have expert testimony. Now, I'm not here to say that in every situation, the trial judge can't make that conclusion. But as I mentioned in the briefing, certainly there are cases. If the lawsuit were against the radiologist for misreading scan, and that was based on the complaint, I think it's fair to say expert testimony would be necessary. The example we talked about earlier, if the cause of action was asserting that the defendant gave my client bad advice on how to structure this transaction, as a result of huge tax ramifications, yeah, we need expert testimony. But in this case, all we're alleging is that the defendant failed to follow the express instructions given to him by his client. And I do want to save a little bit of time, but the other thing I wanted to mention here is what I mentioned in the reply brief. Clarification on the standard for the trial court to follow in dismissing matters under the certificate of review statute. The statute itself provides two options. The defendant, who thinks the certificate is necessary, can move to dismiss the case, or can ask the judge to issue an order saying, plaintiff, you need to come forward with the certificate of review. In practice, the way this works out, again, it could be the 61st day, which is the day after the time period runs, the defendant can come in, move to dismiss, saying no expert or certificate was submitted, and summarily dismiss a claim, notwithstanding that the Colorado Supreme Court has said no expert or certificate is necessary when expert testimony is not necessary. It seems to me to offend traditional notions of due process, not to mention just basic procedures, whether it's a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment, to give the trial court such wide latitude, but again, without any record whatsoever, and come to the conclusion and say, plaintiff, your case is dismissed because I, based on nothing more than the allegations of the complaint, have decided you have to have expert testimony. Your Honor, I submit that if a court, if a trial judge wants to dismiss a claim based on that basis, then it has to follow the regular procedures of the 12b-5 motion, or the defendant wanted to file a motion for summary judgment, file the traditional standard and procedures for summary judgment motion, and say, come to the court and say, Your Honor, we're into this, plaintiff has not submitted expert testimony, therefore can't state a claim. There is a record. It can be litigated. The plaintiff can come forward and say exactly why. The case has been completely flushed out.
Counsel, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I heard you say you wanted to save some time for rebuttal.
Yes.
But I would like you, because I interrupted you earlier, to now tell us what I call part two, the good certificate, the good cause basis for your claim.
Oh, sure. Well, the good cause is we felt we had a good faith belief to not file a certificate because it wasn't necessary. Now, that's certainly one of the prongs of the test. But that's prong one. The second prong is the relative strength or meritorious nature of the claim. And the third prong is whether there would be any prejudice to the defendant to extend that time. In this case, you know, it all happened very early. No discovery, no depositions. So an extension certainly wouldn't prejudice anyone. The allegations of the complaint are pretty straightforward and make claim that by failing to follow the instructions, my client lost out on properties that were in excess of $2 million to purchase, which leaves the good faith or good cause prong of the test. And the courts all recognize, I shouldn't say the courts all recognize, there's the Penrose case that says a good faith belief that you don't need a certificate can support the good cause extension of time. Certainly there would be examples where the party could come up and say, well, yeah, I had good faith belief, I didn't think I needed an expert. Again, going back to the radiologist or the complicated business transaction. Here, Your Honor, we've set forth that there's a law out there that says you don't need expert testimony, at least in other jurisdictions, on this type of claim. Certainly I'm stressed to think that that's what we believed at the time we filed this lawsuit. And the one overriding factor, and I'll end on this, the courts addressing the extension and the good cause of all said, you can't just look at one of the factors and say, well, you didn't meet this factor, therefore you lose on good cause. You have to look at all three because they may reflect one upon the other. And I would submit to you in this particular case, even if you don't believe...
What was your authority for that, counsel, that you have to look at all three, you cannot decide on one alone?
The case is cited in our brief, and I believe it's more than, I would use up my time looking for it, but I will find it when I sit down and then cite it to you.
Okay.
When I come back up. But I would submit that the final two prompts more than outweigh any doubt you have on whether I had a good faith belief that I did not need expert testimony at the time.
And the standard here is please stop it. And the standard here is good cause, not excusable neglect.
I believe it's good cause, but I will also double check that while I sit down.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jared Ellis, registration number 36834, and I appear today on behalf of the defendants, appellees, Floyd Smith, and the law offices of Floyd Smith. Mr. Smith is a real estate attorney who was sued for professional negligence and breach of fiduciary duty by PRDV. The key issue before the court today is whether the trial court correctly dismissed plaintiff's complaint in this case for failure to follow the final certificate of review. Colorado certificate of review statute requires parties who bring claims against licensed professionals based on professional negligence to file a certificate of review, which essentially says, I've consulted an expert, the expert's reviewed the known facts, and the expert has confirmed or expressed an opinion that my allegations don't lack a substantial justification. They aren't frivolous or groundless. The entire purpose of this statute is to weed out frivolous claims early in the proceeding. In this case, plaintiff never filed a certificate of review. The trial court concluded that a certificate of review was necessary, and as a result, under the statute, which mandates dismissal if a certificate of review is necessary and not filed, unless additional time is granted, dismiss plaintiff's claims. We submit that the trial court's ruling in this case was correct, both because the trial court correctly determined that expert testimony was required and because the trial court correctly denied plaintiff's request for additional time.
Now, counsel, you heard your counterpart get up and say, well, this isn't a complicated real estate transaction. We agree that a certificate would be required there. This is something that's clear and palpable in this case. You know, they gave him instructions on where to put the money, and he didn't do it right.
I disagree with him for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, I think, as Judge Daly pointed out, we need to look at the allegations in the complaint in determining the nature and the substance of the claim in this case. And as my opponent admitted, they don't allege in the complaint that this is a claim based on failure to follow instructions. The complaint alleges that Mr. Smith was retained in his professional capacity as a licensed attorney to prepare the documents and the papers necessary to effectuate this multi-phase acquisition. It also alleges that among his responsibilities in that transaction were to obtain releases of liens and to properly prepare warranty deeds. So I think if you look solely at the complaint, this is clearly a case that's very similar to Boyd Grain. It's very similar to I was retained to consummate a real estate deal, and I failed to carry out the real estate deal to the satisfaction of my client. And in the Boyd Grain case, this court held unequivocally that type of claim requires expert testimony. But I think that setting that aside, even if you give plaintiff the credit of this theory that it's based on failure to follow instructions, it's not as cut and dry as plaintiff tries to make it seem. Just because a client gives an instruction doesn't always necessarily mean that an attorney is negligent if he fails to effectuate what the client's instruction is. One of the things that my opponent was talking about when he was up here is, you know, this notion that an attorney who fails to file a claim within the statute of limitations is negligent. And he said, you know, this is a simple issue. A client comes to me, I'm instructed to file a claim, I fail to file it within the statute of limitations. Well, taking another example, what if my client comes to me and tells me to file a frivolous claim? I certainly don't have any obligation to do that, and in fact, I have professional obligations that may prevent that. So I think it's illusory to think that there's just this notion of if my client gives me an instruction and I don't effectuate the objective of that instruction, I'm negligent. And I think that the case law bears that out. The Myers versus Bean case says just because an attorney makes a mistake or just because the outcome isn't what was desired doesn't necessarily mean that the attorney was negligent. Now, I think also if you look at the particular issue in this case, the instruction that was purportedly given was Mr. Smith obtain a release of these liens. I don't think that ordinary laypersons without the assistance of expert testimony can understand the standards applicable to Mr. Smith in that context, or whether or not Mr. Smith breached those standards without expert testimony. And I'll give you a few examples of things that I think experts might need to comment on. First and foremost, I think expert testimony would be required to explain to the jury what a lien is and legal effect of a lien. Second, I think that there would need to be expert testimony concerning what a reasonable attorney would do to find out what liens were on a particular piece of property. And having done that, what a reasonable attorney would do to obtain a release of those liens. Depending on the context, that could require negotiations with third parties, it could require paying them off, and then I think there would also be a question of what a reasonable attorney needs to do in terms of documentation to verify that that lien has been released. Finally, I think that there would need to be expert testimony presented to demonstrate that the attorney's failure to take actions that a reasonable attorney would take under the same circumstances was the cause of the lien's continued existence. And all of those issues, I think, would require expert testimony. So it's really just not as simple as the plaintiff's counsel is trying to make it out. With respect to the need for expert testimony, since we're already on that issue, I think there's a couple of other important points that the court needs to be cognizant of when it's considering whether or not the trial court correctly found that expert testimony is required. The first thing that the court needs to be cognizant of is that there's a deep and well-established body of case law in Colorado that suggests that in almost all cases, claims against attorneys for professional negligence and breach of fiduciary duty require expert testimony. So kind of the general predisposition should be that expert testimony is required, because it's only in rare and unusual exceptional cases that expert testimony is not required. And in fact, to my knowledge, the only exception to that rule that's been recognized in this state is the Jerome versus Cockatoo case, which involved an attorney's failure to file a claim within the statute of limitations. No other exceptions have been recognized. And as we've discussed, this was a complicated real estate transaction. Ordinary jurors who don't have the educational background of an attorney, who don't work in the world of real estate, don't understand what an attorney's responsibility in that context is and can't determine whether or not the attorney adhered to the applicable standard of care without testimony from an expert witness. I'd like to briefly discuss the second issue, which I think we've kind of, the second of the two issues that the court's identified, which is this issue with respect to good cause.
Is it good cause or an excusable neglect?
Well, it's complicated, Judge, because the statute says good cause, but the courts interpreting that statutory language have said when we're determining whether or not good cause exists, we apply a three-factor test. And what's the first factor of that test? Was the failure to file a certificate in a timely fashion the product of excusable neglect? So I think that the answer to your question is, while the statute says good cause, the important consideration is whether excusable neglect excused the untimely filing. But I think that when we're looking at the good cause issue, an important thing to keep in mind here is that this is a discretionary ruling on the part of the trial court. And that means that this court applies a relatively deferential standard of review.
Did the trial court make findings on all three factors of the good cause slash excusable neglect analysis?
I don't believe that it did. I think it made findings with respect to at least one of the factors.
Which one?
I think it made findings with respect to excusable neglect.
Where did it make that?
There's two findings that I think bear on that. The first finding is the court says, I disagree with your argument that a certificate of review is not required. I find that one's required. And then the second finding that the court makes is, you know, if you're going to take this position, it's your responsibility to get some guidance from the court as to whether or not a certificate of review is required. And because you didn't do that, I don't have to allow you to have more time.
Is that last point you just made, is that borne out by the Supreme Court case law, or has that had essentially been rejected? I thought that was a Court of Appeals position in Battis, but not the Supreme Court position in the same case.
Correct, Your Honor. That's what the Court of Appeals held. The Supreme Court said that you don't have to do that.
Right.
I don't think the Supreme Court's ever held that it's not something that a trial court can consider in determining whether excusable neglect exists.
Let me ask a second question. Isn't there case laws stating that in an excusable neglect analysis, a court has to consider all three and balance all three, not that you can determine on one basis alone?
I don't agree that that's correct. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I'll say that is, I think what the case law says is that you have to consider all three factors. But I know for a fact that the Yadon versus Southward case, and I think there are a couple of other cases, state that the court can deny a request for additional time if a plaintiff fails to establish any one of the three factors.
And there's no more recent cases than that, than Yadon versus Southward?
Not that I'm aware of off the top of my head. I may be able to look at it for you, but Yadon is the one that strikes me as the most pertinent.
So Yadon says the trial court must consider all three criteria. Did you acknowledge that the trial court did not consider all three here?
Well, I don't think that's at all true. I think that the trial court did consider all three criteria, and I think that its order makes clear that it's rejecting the request for additional time based upon the failure to demonstrate excusable neglect.
Of which one prong may be illegitimate of the court's findings. It's like, well, you didn't move, you didn't seek guidance beforehand.
Well, I don't agree that it's a legitimate, Judge. And the reason that I say that is, I think that the question in terms of excusable neglect comes down to what would a reasonable attorney do under the circumstances, and has there been an unexpected, unforeseeable event that prevented an attorney from taking that action? In this case, I mean, I think it's perfectly legitimate for the court to say, at best, it's uncertain whether or not expert testimony is required. You didn't ask for any guidance from the court. You didn't ask for an enlargement of time before the deadline. You didn't file a certificate of review, which is not a really difficult thing to do. All you have to do is talk to an expert, have them review the case, and get a certification. And so what the court says is, given that, you have failed to establish excusable neglect.
Isn't that always the case when a party does not provide a certificate of review within 60 days? Aren't all three of those factors evident or exist?
I'm not sure that I understand your question.
Run back through those three factors again. I want to know whether or not they don't exist in every case in which a certificate of review is not filed within 60 days.
Three factors, just so you know, are whether the failure to file was the product of excusable neglect.
No. You didn't go on the factors. You indicated there were three circumstances that indicated that the first factor was not met.
Oh, I apologize.
Yeah, and you indicated that kind of like it wasn't met because it wasn't filed before 60 days, and you didn't ask guidance from the court, and there was a third factor you indicated. What was that?
I think that the only other thing that I mentioned is that the trial court rejected the argument that no certificate of review was required.
And so isn't that essentially the same situation that exists in almost every instance where a plaintiff fails to file within 60 days of certificate of review? Under the trial court's analysis, you can never have excusable neglect.
I don't know that that's necessarily true, Your Honor. And I think that we're viewing it in the context of the arguments made in this case. So, for example, I think you could clearly have excusable neglect if you failed to file a certificate of review or you delayed in filing one because you were ill. With respect to the trial court's findings, I think that, the exception to the situation that you posited is the plaintiff who does say, I'm not sure about this. I don't know whether or not expert testimony is required. And so I'm going to ask the court for guidance on this issue and ask for a conditional enlargement of time to protect myself in case I'm wrong.
In which the Supreme Court says is not required.
Correct. Not required. But I don't think that means necessarily that a trial court can't consider it in determining whether excusable neglect.
If it's not required and you didn't do it, I can dump the case because you didn't do something that wasn't required.
Yes. Thank you. So in any event, I think there's some other important considerations with respect to the issue of excusable neglect. And one of the things that I was kind of alluding to is that the only argument that the plaintiff made in the trial court as to why there was excusable neglect was that there was a good faith belief that they didn't have to file a certificate of review in this case because expert testimony wasn't necessary. Now, in evaluating that argument, I think it's important to note that this argument wasn't based on any established Colorado case law stating that under the circumstances present in this case, expert testimony wasn't required. And plaintiff didn't seek guidance, although it's not required, but didn't seek any guidance from the court of appeal or from the trial court, or seek an extension of time to protect themselves in case their argument was incorrect. The Colorado Lawyer article that we've cited in our brief suggests that this is a step that attorneys should take to protect themselves, particularly when they're faced with an uncertain situation where expert testimony may or may not be required. And so I think that that's an important factor in determining whether excusable neglect existed. But I wanted to touch on one other thing, which is that this whole notion that a good faith belief no certificate of review is required can constitute excusable neglect. There are two cases in Colorado that have addressed this issue. The first one is Shelton versus Penrose. And in the Shelton case, the Supreme Court essentially affirmed a trial court's ruling that excusable neglect had been established based on a good faith belief. But in that case, the important factor was that the trial court had initially ruled no certificate of review was required, and the plaintiff relied on that ruling. And the second case that's important is the Ehrlich Feedlot case, and that's a case from the Court of Appeals. And in the Ehrlich Feedlot case, same situation happened. The plaintiff said, I relied on this trial court order. The trial court reversed itself 5 weeks later, and this court affirmed the trial court's decision dismissing the claim and held that that reliance was not excusable neglect. So I think it's quite questionable whether the good faith or reported good faith belief in this case constitutes excusable neglect. We ask that you affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge. I'm going to apologize in advance because I'm going to be talking fast. The case that talks about all three factors is the RMB Services v. Trular, 151 P3rd 673. I'll quote from page 676. Trial court's failure to evaluate the three factors alone warrants dismissal. Order of dismissal cannot be affirmed as a proper exercise of discretion because the evidence is no consideration of the relevant factors. There was no such consideration given in the trial court's order here. I also want to quickly talk about this discretion and defendant's position that trial court has broad discretion in the cases cited therein. That's not what those cases talk about. Defendant is taking them out of context. arguments have been made before on the statute saying that the certificate of review statute is jurisdictional, and therefore the trial, if the certificate is not filed, it's just done. This court has held, no, the court has discretion to consider whether the certificate needs to be filed or not. These cases did not hold that the court had wide discretion to do whatever it wanted at any time. I'll disagree with one other thing my opposing counsel said. He indicated the trial court found expert testimony was necessary. Not true. Trial court never addressed the issue because it shifted the burden to us and said, because you didn't come to me 61 before the 61st day to ask for more time, I'm not going to consider that argument. So the court never said yay or nay. We're saying the court needs to make that consideration. We heard a lot about, well, this case might be complicated, it might be this, it might be that, if the lawyer does this, if the lawyer does that, it might need expert testimony. It's all irrelevant. We don't know. We don't know any of that. None of that's in the record. There is no record. All we know is we have a claim where we've alleged the attorney failed to follow the instructions of his client to release liens on property, something anyone who's ever bought a home, any lay person can understand. No expert testimony is needed. We ask that the court reverse.
Counsel, before you leave the podium, I have a question. I want to make sure I'm looking at the right order, because you just said the trial court didn't find that expert testimony was required. Quote, thus, the court finds that expert testimony is required to prove plaintiff's professional negligence claim.
Well, then I misspoke. You know, I don't believe the trial court ever seriously considered that argument. And I think what you need to do is look at that language in the context of the earlier part of the order, where the judge says the burden was on the plaintiff to come to me first and say, you have to file. Then I'll take a look.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.